don't listen to your parents. I go, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. They, okay, in one ear, out the other.
Oh my God. Yeah, great. Now no one else will come on our podcast. Only Moz will come back on.
تو وا کن پسر و سر تو بالا کن دختر و همه گی بریم قاشق زنی حالا دیگه بس دشمنی مردم دیگه فال گوش نه.
There it is. It's doing it. Great. Okay, we're good.
Okay, fabulous. It's so nice to, I feel like you're, it's going to sound so offensive. It's so nice to have someone from our parents' generation who knows how to use technology.
How dare you, Millie? How dare you?
Millie.
No, it's just, how could I not comment? It's like, I don't even know what QuickTime, I don't even know what you're talking about. Like, oh, okay, yeah, QuickTime player sounds good.
You don't know QuickTime? That's the,
okay, I know what that is, but I had no idea you could double record.
It's on a Mac. It's called, have you heard of Macintosh?
I think what's that? I know that's one, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, my mom just makes the best Macintosh for it.
So, Moz Jabrani, welcome to Persian Girl Podcast. This is a major honor.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
I remember in 7th or 6th grade when I first saw your stand-up, like, you were the reason why my classmates understood what Persian culture was. I'm not sure if that's necessarily a good thing.
I'll take that. Why not? Sure.
Like, you made a staple, like, phrase that everyone would use when they would talk to a Persian girl. Like people would, like, come up to me, like, oh, like, you're Persian, like, from New York. Oh, you're from Great Neck. I'm like, yeah, but I'm not. And then they interrupt me and they go, I'm not a typical Persian girl. And, like,
typical Persian girl is Max Amini. So you have the wrong comedian on the show.
Oh, my God.
You guys got to do your research. Girls. Listen, typical Persian girl was Max. The quote that people would quote me from.
I'm Persian like the cat, meow.
That's the one that people would quote
me from. Yeah, I know. That's so funny because I told Natalie.
Beforehand, she's like, don't say anything about the tomato soup. And I'm like, yeah, I know that's Max Amini.
Well, you know, it's funny because everybody, and I'm sure as you guys, your podcast continues, people will associate you together and will call one Natalie, the other one Millie, and mix it up. Similarly with Max and I, so I started stand up a little bit before Max. And, you know, when you do stand up, you don't write a joke going, oh, this is going to be a joke that everyone's going to, you know, take the tagline and repeat. You just do it because you're doing your joke. And then people will come up to you and be like, hey, Moz Jabrani, Persian cat, meow. And you're like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. So you see that it's happening. And then, but then what happens is, as you guys just experience yourselves, once Max got in the game and he started becoming better and better known, then people start mixing up. Like, at that time, there was also Kayvon. There was other comedians. People would come up to me all the time and quote someone else's jokes and be like, you know what my favorite joke of yours is? And they would say someone else's joke. And I'd be like, that's not my joke. They'd be like, no, it really is. And I was like, I swear to God, it's not. Like, I think it is. I'm like, no, I know my jokes. So it happens all the time.
I feel like at the same time, it could be like an insult and a compliment. Like, it's almost more of an insult to the other comedians because it's almost like you're so well known that anytime someone hears a Persian joke, they're like, oh, Moz Jabrani.
Yeah, Moz Jabrani.
Good save, Natalie. Good save. I like you brought it all the way around. Yes, I will take it as a compliment. The other ones are non-memorable. None of these other comedians are memorable. I'm the only memorable one.
Yeah, great. Now no one else will come on our podcast. Thank you.
No, now only Moz, now you got to bring Max back on and be like, my favorite joke of yours is Persian like the cat meow, and then go from there.
Well, maybe this is us kind of being like the Hollywood douchebag, like, like how they treat women. Like, they were just trying to even the scale, you know.
What's that, the Hollywood? I didn't hear you. You kind of ate your words at the end. What'd you say? The Hollywood what?
The Hollywood douchebag. Like, you know how they
By the way. By the way, again, you guys are the first ones to do it. And you're not only, and I've had people do it, not just with like me and Max, as you just said, when you're brown and you're not Latino and you're not, you know, I've had people come up to me. One of my friends, Ahmed, who's an Egyptian American comedian, I've had people come up to me and be like, oh, hey, Ahmed, how are you? And I'm like, I'm not Ahmed. We don't look anything alike.
Oh, my God.
I go, I'm not Ahmed. And they're like, you're not? And I'm like, no, I'm Maz. And they go, oh. They mix us all together, so don't worry about it.
No, I do worry about it. We don't want that. I mean, and that's like, that's something we want to talk about. We'll get to that eventually, but, you know, tell us a little bit about the beginnings and the origins of how you got into comedy.
Well, you know, Persian Girl Podcast, so you guys come from the Persian background, which I've come to realize is similar to a lot of other immigrant backgrounds, whether it's like Indian or Nigerian or Chinese. A lot of our parents are the types of parents who want their kids to be overachieving. They want us to be lawyer, doctor, engineer. It's become a cliche now because we all say it, but it's so true because the generation before your parents, which is my age, that before that, my parents, I came here in late 78, and I was 6 years old, and they wanted me, you know, they wanted lawyer, doctor, engineer, all that stuff. And going through school, there was a lot of, within the community, they'll say, we have a name in the community. Don't mess up our name. You need to go to college. You need to do this and that. So college was always a thing on my mind. But around the seventh grade, when I was in junior high school, it was seventh and eighth grade. I grew up in Northern California, Marin. So there weren't a lot of Persians around. I had a handful of Persian friends, but a lot of white friends and, you know, a handful of black friends, but it was really white. And so seventh grade, I auditioned for the school musical. By the way, at that point, I was also a big fan of Eddie Murphy because Eddie Murphy was the rock star comedian. He was what would be, let's say, Kevin Hart today. That was Eddie Murphy back then. And there was only one Eddie Murphy. I mean, he was just...
There's still only one Eddie Murphy. I love him.
There still is only one. But back then, he was the closest... You know, Eddie Murphy, when you listen to Eddie Murphy, he was saying that he wanted to be like Elvis. So Elvis was, whatever, the king of rock and roll. He wanted to be the king of comedy. So he was like... He took stand-up comedy to another level. So anyway, loved him, wanted to be like him. School play, seventh grade, I audition. I get a role of like one of the background dancers because it was seventh and eighth grade. It was a musical called The Boyfriend, and all the eighth graders had the leads. The seventh graders were in the back dancing. We had a director. Her name was Shirley Bonbright. Shirley Bonbright said, "Whenever you're on stage, whether you're a background or you're a lead or whatever, in a musical, you should always be smiling when you sing and dance. Smile, always smile." And I took that to heart. And so one day I was under the weather, feeling sick, showed up at rehearsal. Because the other thing they tell you when you do a play, they go, doesn't matter what part you have, you need to show up at rehearsals. Because if you don't, you're throwing the whole thing off. So I showed up. I was sick. I go, "Miss Bonbright, I'm a little sick, but I came." She goes, "Great." I get up on stage. I'm singing. I'm dancing. I'm smiling. She stops the whole rehearsal. Everybody stop. Look at him. He's sick. He came, he's singing, he's dancing, he's smiling. You all got to learn from him. And it was one of those moments where I was looking around and going, is she talking to me? And I was like, oh, wow. And so I think that like reinforced my enjoyment and confidence in being on stage. So that led to me really wanting to do it more. And so the next year in eighth grade, I did the musical again and I had the lead that year in Little Abner. It was called Little Abner. And then throughout high school, I had a great theater program. And every time I would be in a theater program, the director of the program would say, "Yeah, you know what? You've got what it takes to do this." And I thought, "Oh, that's cool," because I tell people I feel alive on stage. And a lot of people find that elsewhere. Some people feel alive in an operating room. Some people feel alive painting. Some people feel alive surfing. There's a million things people can do. But if you talk to most people, if they're lucky enough, because some people haven't found what it is that makes them feel alive. But if they're lucky enough, they found what it is that they love to do. And then if they're even luckier, they've been able to turn that into a career and do it. So for me, there was a lot of detours dealing with my parents because, you know, I told them in high school, I said, "Oh, I want to go to acting school." And they didn't know what that meant. And I honestly didn't know, how does an actor or comedian make it? So at some point going into college, my parents convinced me, "Hey, why don't you go become a lawyer and then maybe you can just do plays and stand up on the side." So I went to UC Berkeley undergrad. I did political science. And then my junior year, and I always recommend to anybody who's in college, I say, take a year, get out of this country, go somewhere else. My junior year, I spent a year in Italy. I went to Italy and, you know, learned Italian fluently, and it was amazing. And I was immersed in the programs, and I had an Italian girlfriend. And while I was there, there was a professor, and I loved what he was doing. His name was Vincenzo Pace, and he was this guy with a goatee with like the blazer and the elbow patch, and he had a pocket watch, and he would start the class, and he'd look at the watch, and he'd close it, and he'd say, okay, now let's talk about whatever it was. So I'm watching him, and I go, oh, maybe I'll be a professor, because if I become a professor, my parents will be happy because it's a prestigious job, and I'll be happy because I'll get to be in front of people. So when I came back to L.A., by then my family had moved to L.A. When I come back to the States, I tell my mom, I go, I want to go get my PhD and be a professor. And again, our Persian parents were worried, you know, professor, they don't make money. What are you going to do? I said, this is what I want to do. So I got into UCLA PhD program, went to, while I was there, I was like, well, you know, I miss being on stage. So even though I'm in a PhD program, let me audition for their main play to see if I can get in. Audition, got into the main play. So what would happen is by day I'd go to class at UCLA, poli sci class, and by night I'd go to rehearsals. And at night when I was at rehearsals, I was loving it. And by day when I was in the classes, we always would ask, what's the job of a professor? And they would say, well, you write a book, and if you're lucky enough, some politician will use your theory to do something. And I was like, God, that doesn't feel very fulfilling. So I dropped out of the PhD program at UCLA right away. And then I just started like doing little acting things here and there while also having a day job at an advertising agency. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s, I was 26 years old, working in advertising as an assistant, doing a play. Your parents might know this play. It was called The Blind Date and the Wedding, which was about a Persian guy who goes on a blind date with a Persian girl. The guy's a charlatan. He lies about being rich. The girl's a gold digger. She falls for him. They're perfect for each other. And it was being done in LA and New York, and in the big, it was big in the Persian Jewish community because my friend who wrote it was a Persian Jewish guy. The producers were Persian Jewish guys. And that play, I was somebody who was at my advertising agency, this older gentleman by the name of Joe Ryan. He saw me doing the play, and he goes, hey, you're good at this. Have you ever thought about doing this? And I said, Joe, throughout my life, I wanted to get into acting school. Then I wanted to go do stand-up comedy. Then I wanted to do this. And my parents always pushed me in another direction. And I said, you know, I'm thinking I'm going to save up money. And when I turn 30, in 4 years, when I turn 30, I'm going to try it. And he goes, Maz, I'm in my 60s right now. And there were some things that I wanted to do in my 20s, and I never did it. So he goes, if you really want to do it, do it. And it was a light bulb moment. And I decided to do it. And that was the moment when all the weight of the world got lifted off my shoulders. I just enrolled in some improv acting classes that led to stand-up comedy classes. And that was 24 years ago. And I even wrote a book called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV. And I dedicated it to Joe Ryan.
Wow, that's so sweet.
Shout out to Joe. Without him.
Shout out to Joe.
We wouldn't have Maz. I want to say it really is inspiring because, I don't know, even for Millie and I, like, my dad still looks at me and he's like, what is this broadcast you do? And I'm like, first of all, it's a podcast, not a broadcast. And then like my uncles will be like, what's this radio thing? You like, no one even calls it the right thing. Even when they're trying to like.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to. We come from like very different families. And even it's interesting, like there are so many different types of Persians within the, like you can't even say community anymore. Like, as you mentioned, there's Persian Jews, there's Persian Muslims. Majority of like Persian Muslims we know are at least secular, and a lot of my Muslim friends are always like, when they hear about the things that we grew up with and like me and Natalie in our communities, they're like, that's so conservative. What? Like your parents still believe in those things? And that's why I was curious. It's like, it's good that you brought up about your parents, like how they were receptive and like, how did that, and not that I want to focus it entirely on how they perceived you, but it's like, when did they start respecting really your career?
You know, I was I was the oldest son. I had an older sister, and then I was the next kid, the oldest son. My dad was a self-made businessman who took care of all of his brothers and sisters because he lost his father at a young age. So he used to put it on my shoulders a lot. I had two younger brothers, and he would say, you need to take your brothers, take care of your brothers. You got to be the man of the house. You got to do, you know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff, responsibility. So from a young age, I think I was pretty mature, and I was respectful. I respected my parents as we are taught to. But I think at some point, I don't know when it was, but I started to kind of look around and go, wait a minute, if he wants me to be kind of this leader and, you know, independent and take care of everybody, then I just stand on my own. Like, I got to make my own decisions. And I think you start to rebel against your parents a little bit, hopefully. Some people never do, and it's unfortunate in my opinion, because your parents want what's best for you, but they don't know what's best for you. Matter of fact, I was lucky enough to give the commencement speech at UC Berkeley in 2017. And one of the things I said, don't listen to your parents. I go, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. Because again, even if my kids came to me and said, what do you think I should do? Well, I want a secure future for them. So I would say, oh, you should go to graduate school, get a degree in law or medicine, or go be a computer scientist, something that I know that once you graduate, you can go and apply and someone will hire you, and then you can get that money and you can buy a house. And that's what I think. But I don't know what the heart of my daughter, what she wants to do, or the heart of my son. My daughter might say, I want to go be a DJ. And I go, what? How do you do that? But she's really good at it. She loves music. She's got a great ear for it. She's fantastic with what she does. My son loves Dungeons and Dragons. He might say, I want to go do Dungeons and Dragons as a career. And I go, what? How does that work? Matter of fact, he actually did come to me and he was doing Dungeons and Dragons. And just to put in my mind that it's okay, because they do it for, it takes like 2-3 hours. He's 13, by the way. I was like, can I ask you a question? I go, when you do Dungeons and Dragons, in the game, are you creating the world as you go? And he goes, yeah. And I go, okay. And in my mind, I go, that means he's writing. Like, that's going to be a writing skill in the future. He might end up writing the next Game of Thrones. I don't know, because he's practicing this. So all of that to say that I started to rebel against my parents. Like, even going to Italy when I was a junior in college, my father had gone back to Iran at that time because he'd lost all of his money in America, goes back to Iran to try and do business. So since he'd gone back, my mother and my aunt at that point were trying to convince me that I should not go to Italy. I should stay in the United States. And not only should I stay in the United States, I should transfer from Berkeley down to UCLA, where my mom is living, to be around her, to help her out with my younger brothers. You know, we're very clanny. We're very familial, right? Everyone chips in. And I told them, I said, guys, I've been preparing to go to Italy for a year and a half. I took Italian language classes in the States, and I went through the whole process and studied, you know, applications and all this stuff. I said, I can't pull out now. I go, if I pull out, I will live in regret the rest of my life. So I went, and I remember for like the first few weeks, I think my mom was upset at me. I think my aunt was upset at me, but it ended up being the best year of my life. So you come to realize you got to live for you. You got to do what makes you happy. And if you find a way to make you happy, then you can start to make others happy. So when I went into this world of comedy, even, or when I dropped out of graduate school to go pursue acting, my mom at that point was like, what do you mean you're leaving graduate school? Like, you didn't become a lawyer, didn't become a professor. Do you want to become an actor? Like, what is that? She goes, at least become a mechanic. And I go, what do you mean? I go, how'd you go from lawyer to mechanic? She goes, people need mechanics. Nobody needs an actor. And it's true. Like, then I realized, you know, if you put yourself in their frame of mind for a second before taking all of their words as gold, if you just think about it for a second, your parents, my parents, I myself, we came from a revolution. Now, I was a kid when I came. My parents had a established life. You know, so currently in America, they're talking about there might be a civil war. Imagine if a civil war broke out, or what we're seeing in Ukraine right now, and you guys had to get up and go to Brazil where you don't speak any Portuguese. Well, you need to have a skill in order to get a job. So my mom was saying, you know, if you learn how to fix cars, you can go anywhere. She's coming from a revolution. In her mind, there's going to be a revolution. You have to leave the country. So I tried to understand her, and I tried to understand them, but I also took their words with a grain of salt. I would say, okay, in one ear, out the other. I never did it to be like, oh, do you respect me? You know, people say a lot of times that people in their lives are trying to gain their parents' acceptance, right? I I think I went another way. It wasn't about gaining their acceptance. It was more about, like, you know, realizing that their words weren't as wise as I thought they were growing up. We all think our parents know everything until you get old enough and you go, wait a minute, you had failures. You know, my mom and dad's marriage didn't work out. I go, well, so why are you giving me advice on marriage if yours didn't work out? My mom never had a career of that sort. So how can you give me a career advice when you haven't had that? And she's a great woman, by the way. And it was interesting to see her coming around. I think when she started to see, because really what they want, your parents want you to have a secure life. So the best way, the analogy I make is, I go, if you're in a car and you're driving, the person in the passenger seat, if you're driving fast around the turns, every time you turn, the person in the passenger seat puts their hand on the dashboard. Oh my God, slow down. Oh my God. You're driving though and you feel comfortable. I got it. Don't worry. Your parents are the ones in the passenger seat. You're the one driving. So they want what's best for you. So they want you to go 55 miles an hour, put your seatbelt on, let's all just relax and get through it. But you're saying, no, I got it. But you're not doing it to please them. And at some point in my career, when my mom started to see that, oh, you're actually getting paid and making a living. Oh, people were coming up to her and going like, oh, I like your son. And she's like, oh. So I think that made her feel like, oh, this is successful. So they came around like that. And my father, unfortunately, he spent most of the rest of his life in Iran. And he came to America towards the end of his life. And he knew I was doing well, but he didn't, the same way you're saying your parents are like, what's this, you know, broadcast? And you're like, it's podcast. It was foreign to my dad, really, what I was doing necessarily, you know. Which again, you take it without, you know, you got to take all of this stuff with a grain of salt, because people don't know. Americans in America, there's Americans you probably talk to, they don't know how a podcast works. They don't know what it is. They don't know how it works, right? So the same thing for comedy, the same thing for acting. You know, I might not be in a movie or a television show for several years, but I'm touring and I'm successfully touring, and I might have just done a show where 2,000 people came out and saw me and I felt like a rock star that night. And I could come across somebody and they'd be like, oh, wow, where have you been? What have you been doing? Any shows? Like, are you okay? Do you need money? And I'm like, no, I just did a sold out show last night. And they don't know.
Yeah.
So you don't take it. You can't be insulted by it. You do what you love doing. And then you don't do it for anybody else. You do it for you. And I really believe that if you do what you love and you're able to make yourself happy, then you're able to hopefully provide for other, you're in a good frame of mind. Like, I very rarely walk around the streets like cussing people out, because I'm in a good place. Like, I'm floating everywhere I go, because I got to do what I love doing. You know how many times I've told my wife, I go, I can't believe they're paying me to come up with this crap. You know, like, I'll come up with something silly and I go to my wife and kids and I'll be like, hey guys, here's a dad joke. And I'll do the dad joke and they'll roll their eyes. I go, that's what they're paying me for. So
I actually have a question about when you first started writing jokes and going into comedy as opposed to acting. Did you always use your family and your background as like your main focus in your comedy?
Or is it, Natalie, what happened was, since I was a kid, I was doing plays and musicals and all that stuff. And I loved being on stage. But I also wanted to be a comedian. And the problem was, I did not have my own confidence yet to write my own material. So, because the way I looked at it, when you're doing a play, there's you, there's the other actors, there's a director, there's a writer. So if it doesn't go well, you can blame other people. When you're doing comedy, you wrote it, you're performing it. It's all you. So when I was 17, in my theater program in high school, I tried to do stand-up. And at that point, I'm a 17-year-old boy. So all the material was about sex. And I wrote the material, and then the next day I would read it and I go, oh, this is, it's not so good. Like, I wasn't confident enough. If I were confident at that point, I might have gone on stage and done those jokes, but I didn't have the confidence. So let it go. And then it wasn't until years later, after the conversation with Joe Ryan, and I ended up in that in the stand-up comedy class, there's a lady named Judy Carter who's got a stand-up comedy class, which, by the way, if anyone's looking to get into stand-up comedy, she's written a book called The Comedy Bible, so pick that up. In that class, they tell you, they go, write what you know, but also write what makes you different. So we'd be sitting in this class with 10 students and they go around the class and they'd be like, what makes you different? And like, they would say, like, she's broken it down into like sentences. She goes, you're supposed to say, it's crazy when fill in the blank. it sucks when fill in the blank. I love it when fill in the, like there was like five phrases and you got to fill in the blank with something pertaining to you. So she'd be going around the class, like let's say somebody's gay and they'd be like, you know, it's hard being gay in Oklahoma. She'd be like, great, go write about that. You know, so somebody's like, I don't know, short. It sucks being short on a basketball team. Oh my God, write about that. So they come around to me. What differentiates me in this class is like I was the only person of Middle Eastern descent. So there was like, it's hard being Iranian in America. More specific, it's hard growing up Iranian in America. Okay, go home and write jokes about that. So you take that theme. So like one of my early jokes was, oh, it was hard growing up Iranian in America because I could never get anyone to spend the night because the parents always thought we're going to keep the kid and keep hostages. So, you know, then I would do the act out, my mom calling their parents and being like, yeah, we just want to keep Jesse maybe for a day or two, maybe a week. And the parents like, no way, you know, like, so whatever it was. It started from there because they were saying, talk about that stuff. So that differentiates me on stage. But as I went, first of all, when I first started, I wasn't performing at all for like, there was no Iranians, like the audience wasn't Iranian. It was, I was at the comedy clubs, I was at coffee shops, I was wherever I could go. And when you go to the comedy, like you go to the comedy store, when you become a regular at the comedy store in Los Angeles, that's where like a lot of the biggest names had gone through, from Richard Pryor to Eddie Murphy to Jim Carrey to David Letterman, Jay Leno, Louis C.K., Joe Rogan, you name it, everyone's gone through that club, you know. Kind of like in New York, they've got the Comedy Cellar. So when you start out at that club, you have to audition in front of the owner, Mitzi Shore. You would do, and she's passed away since, but you would do 3 minutes, and if she liked you, she'd say, come back a week later, do 6 minutes. You come back a week later, do six. By the way, it wasn't her. Somebody would tell, she was like a mafia boss. She'd sit in the back, you'd do your set, and then somebody would come up to you and be like, Mitzi said, come back and do another six. Okay, Mitzi said, come back, do 10. So by the time you do your 10, and by the way, there's an audience there, but it's like on open mic night, so the audience doesn't know what they're getting, and it's a lot of trash, and then you got to come up and try and be funny. After 10 minutes, you'd walk to the exit. There's an exit at the back where she's sitting right next to it, and if she grabbed your arm, that was like, oh my God, she's about to make me a regular. And if she let you walk through, that means come back in a year. So I'm going by and she grabs my arm and I go, oh my God, it's happening. And this is where Eddie Murphy, in my mind, Eddie Murphy had performed here. So I'm like, this is like, my career is about to be made. Pulls me close. She goes, you're very funny. That's how she talked. You're very funny. I go, thank you, Mitzi. She goes, I'm going to make you a regular. I go, thank you, Mitzi. And then she goes, have you thought about wearing the outfit? I go, what outfit? She goes, you know, the hat and the gown. I go, okay. And I walk out and I realize she wanted me to wear a turban and like a dishdasha on stage because she wanted me to be like this, the Middle Eastern guy. She didn't have any Middle Eastern comics there. So I had to like talk my way out of doing this because they called me the next day, the booker. She's like, oh, I heard you're going to wear the outfit. I was like, oh my God. I don't want to wear the outfit on stage. Like it's, you know, not a good idea. And then they were like, no, Mitzi has helped a lot of comedians come up with their character. This Mitzi sees something for you. And long story short, I basically told her, listen, if I'm dressing like a mullah on stage telling jokes and it gets back to the Islamic Republic, they might send some people here to take me out and also take the club out.
You're going to have a fatwa.
They weren't going to do that, but I told them that. And so they were like, oh, okay, just wear something comfortable. So after that, though, once you become a regular, the time slots they give you, because the shows start at 9 p.m. and they go to 2 a.m. So when you're new at the club, they'll be like, all right, you get the 1 a.m. spot. So I'd be up at 1 a.m. in front of like four drunk people, like tourists from Australia or something, and I'd just be doing my thing. And some of the jokes were, oh, I'm Iranian, blah, blah, blah. Some of the jokes were like, oh, you know, whatever, sex related. Some of them were, I mean, it was anything. It was just like, be funny. So early on, that's what was happening. But once the Persian community found out, oh, there's this guy doing comedy, comes from a Persian background, they started coming. And I think obviously they were loving the Persian jokes because they're like, oh, he's talking about us. So some of the other jokes just weren't landing. So all of a sudden, like people would come up, hey, Persian like a cat, meow. But they wouldn't necessarily reference some of the other jokes I was doing. And to this day, if you look at my six comedy specials, if you watch them from beginning to end, sure, there's some Persian stuff, but first of all, it starts to evolve. Instead of saying Persian this, Persian that, I start saying immigrant this, immigrant that, because I realize a lot of immigrants have a lot in common. And throughout, there's a lot of kid material. There's political material. Like my Netflix special is called Immigrant. A lot of Trump material, a lot of kid material, trying to have sex while you have young kids at the house material. Like, there's all that stuff. My most recent one's called Pandemic Warrior. It's on Peacock TV. There's jokes about the pandemic. So it's evolved. And what happens is you evolve as a comic and you go, I don't have to necessarily always say, oh. And also, I don't want to isolate my audience because my audience is mixed. Like, you, depending on which city you see me in, like you go to Denver in a room of like 200 people, there's like maybe 20 Persians at most. Like, they're all white and Indian and Asian, and it's mixed, which is what I like. I hate having a homogenous crowd of any kind. So it all evolves and you go away from that and you just talk about you.
I was going to say something like opposing that, like when you first got into comedy, did you feel that no one could differentiate Persian from Arab, for example? So you had to just like throw yourself into this vague term of like, oh, this is the brown comic. And was that frustrating for you? Did you feel like you were having to be a caricature at any point?
No, that goes back to what I was saying. You get to make fun of that stuff. That's the beauty. Because you come from this background, you can show. This is the first time, like, I started here. Omid Jalili was in London. And I think Ahmed might have been, I think he was doing it. He was the Egyptian guy. But a lot of us, I think, quickly found that theme of flipping it on its head. The same way, like, a black comic might go up on stage and be like, hey, I'm a black guy and I'm not going to try to mug you. Because every time you would watch a movie, a black guy was mugging you. Yeah. Similarly for us, we were able to make fun of that stereotype. So I would talk about like a joke I used to do. I used to say, you know, when people find out you're Middle Eastern in Hollywood, they go, oh, you're Middle Eastern? Oh, great. Can you say, I will kill you in the name of Allah? And I go, I could, but what if I played the doctor in this film? They go, great. And then you can hijack the hospital. I go, no, you're not getting the point. So I'm making fun of how they see us. And as a matter of fact, that whole Persian cat meow joke had a whole other part about
the gas prices.
Me being able to talk, me being able to explain, I would say I created this like imaginary American friend, but I'd hadn't questions like this before because I'm sure you guys have experienced this. You go, I'm Persian or my parents are from Iran. They go, oh, like Saddam Hussein. You go, no, that's different. So the joke I used to do about how can you tell Arabs and Persians apart? I said, Persians talk slowly, like we just shot some heroin. We're falling asleep. How are you? I'm Persian, like the cat meow. Arab talk very fast, like they have the cocaine and they're talking to you. Habibi, yalla. So that joke came out of me trying to explain to a white audience how you tell us apart. And I'm able to do that because I'm saying, you idiots keep messing it up. So rather than playing into like showing up and being like, you know, hello, I am brown guy here today, you know, rather than playing that character, I was turning it on its head and going, you guys are such idiots. You think just because I'm from the Middle East, I'm an expert on the Middle East. Like, I know what's going on with the gas prices. I pay the same price as you. So that actually became a great tool for me to use to kind of make fun of how stupid their generalizations were.
I mean, Maz, I don't know who screwed you over, but me and Millie are getting free gas. I don't like. Did you not know about the deal?
That's the problem. They don't let. They didn't tell me about this. I haven't paid my fees for the year. I know you got to pay every year.
Yeah,
you
get it's a membership. It's the
Persian gas card. I haven't. Yeah, I gotta renew.
Yeah, I use code PGP15.
Yeah, but actually, that is like something funny. I think with being Persian and Jewish is that most people automatically assume, like when I tell them my mom's from Israel, my dad's from Iran, they're like, oh, how does that work? You know, because like, two different religions and they hate each other. And I'm like, no one on this planet has heard of a Persian Jew. Like, no one thinks that they automatically, they just don't, it doesn't click in their head that we exist.
See, here's the thing. We all grow up and depending on who your parents associate with and all that stuff, sometimes you end up in a bubble of sorts. Now, the bubble I grew up in was California, so I'm pretty liberal. And I go to some other places thinking everybody has seen the diversity that I've seen, and I realize they haven't. So rather than getting upset when they go, so you guys are Arabs. And I'm going, no, I just go, listen, not a big deal. I'm not offended, but let me just explain to you. That's like telling a Mexican you're Cuban. They're different countries. You know, there's similar languages, similar words, but different countries, different. So similar to that, when you grow up in your world, let's say around Persian Jews, or if you grew up around Persian Muslims, whatever it was, you think, oh, everybody knows what's what. Like, as you just said, when I tell people, I've had times when I tell people there's Persian Jews, they go, what? Or when I tell people the biggest population of Jews in the Middle East outside of Israel is still in Iran. And they go, what? I go, yeah. I go, we had Jews in Iran and we still do. And then I go, you know, the people getting persecuted even more than the Jews in Iran are the Baha'is. Like,
that's yeah, I know. They're like, what is that? And then,
we need to do an episode on Baha'is, honestly.
I know.
We need to shed some light.
And then they'll step back and go, what? What's a Baha'i? And then I go, all right, let me explain it to you. So I don't, you can't be offended by it, but you also got to realize nobody had, they didn't have the same upbringing you did. And you grew up in your own bubble where when you go to, let's say, Kansas City and somebody sees you and they go, what are you? Are you Latina? Are you this? Are you that? And you're like, no, I'm Persian. They go, oh, is that France?
And you're like, exactly. Oh my God. Yeah. They're like, what's Persia? And I'm like, well, technically we had an empire.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think we're offended. And, you know, like the way we met was we heard you on the street talking about cancel culture. I just think like we were just remarking, oh, that's interesting. And yeah, we did grow up in a bubble. Me growing up in Beverly Hills and Natalie in Great Neck, these are like huge hubs of Persian Jews. Yeah.
And you get to explain to them, you know, if you take it as a teaching moment, and I'm not saying you guys get frustrated. I was saying in general, like we all got to remind ourselves people had different experiences.
Exactly.
But if you take it as a teaching moment, so there's been many times when I've been places where I'm really not an expert on Iran and the history and all that stuff, but compared to other people in the room, I am. So when I start telling them, in 1953, there was a guy named Mohammad Mossadegh, and there was an overthrow, and America did the overthrow as with the CIA, and then we came in late 78, and there was a revolution, and I start telling them these things, like, what? So like just in 2020, when the Trump administration bombed, they killed Soleimani, General Soleimani, who was the Iranian general. My friend Whitney Cummings, I don't know if you know who Whitney is, a comedian. She's very famous. She has her own podcast called The Good For You Podcast. And she wanted to talk to somebody who's an expert on Iran. So she brought me and this former CNN political analyst named Jessica Yellen to explain Iran to her. And Whitney's pretty world traveled, but there was a lot of moments of her going, really? I didn't know, you know, and I'm sure her audience too was like, I had no idea. So it becomes an opportunity for us to become the expert in the room when they don't know much about your background.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, the older I've gotten, the more, I don't want to say like the word cool, but like almost the more like interesting it is to people when someone's not just American, when like people want to know is what I'm trying to say. So when I tell them something, they look confused. They don't look like weirded out or judgmental. They're like, oh, that's so interesting. Teach me. Like they tend to have like a look on their face like they want to know more.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're right. I think most people are curious. And I tend to lead with, you know, I just did a show for some event and I asked the organizer, I said, what's the audience? And they go, a lot of good old boys from Texas. And I was like, why am I here? And they were like, They chose you to do their event. I said, all right. And I tried at some point to point out that, you know, I grew up in America. I left Iran when I was 6, but I didn't go back. I've only gone back once for 2 weeks in my 20s. But I hadn't really left America for a large part of my life. You know, even in college, I went to Mexico, like some resort. That doesn't count. So it wasn't until around 2007 when I was part of this Axis of Evil comedy tour where we toured all over the world. We ended up in the Middle East and we did shows in Egypt, the UAE, so Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Jordan, Kuwait, and Beirut. And I got a chance to really travel outside of the US. And one of the things that really landed, this was like middle of the whole Bush administration, past September 11th, people's perceptions of Muslims and Middle Easterners and Arabs and Iranians was all like, oh, you all want the destruction of America. You go there and you go, no, nobody, everybody in these countries is just trying to, you know, make a living, feed their family, maybe enjoy some entertainment and call it a night. Like, nobody's waking up in the morning going, death to America. Nobody cares. Sure, there's a handful who might be radicalized and that's how they're thinking. But for the most part, everyone is just like the people here. So a lot of times I try to reiterate that to people. And I mentioned that on that stage in front of the good old boys where I said, if you travel, you'll see most people are very similar. And as a matter of fact, when you go to people that are like, let's say on the far right on the Christian side who go, oh, you know, these Muslims hate us. I go, really, if you took a conservative Christian and a conservative Muslim and a conservative Jew and you put them all in the same room, they're going to have a lot more in common than you could imagine. Like, they're all going to be anti-gay. They're all going to be like pro-family, like less rights for women. Like, they're all like, if they're on the right side, on the far right, they're going to have that in common. So I go, you guys have a lot more in common with a person you hate than you know. So I just try to reiterate whenever I come across people that don't know the background, I go, one of the best things I recommend, and this is a pro tip for you guys, if you ever run into somebody who's like, oh, what is this? I don't know. I always go, listen, do yourself a favor. Find a Persian restaurant. Go there. Order the rice. Order the kebab. Order whatever they give you. You're going to love it. Because Persian food really is some of the best food in the world. And it's a great way to get people to dip their toe into the Persian culture. It's a very welcoming way for them to come in.
You know, also to get into Persian culture more, everyone can listen to your podcast as we wrap up this interview.
With Tehran.
Yeah, so Tehran and I have Back to School with Maz Jobrani, where we bring in all kinds of guests, and it's from like athletes to scientists to, economic people. Like, we've really tried to, it started when my kids would ask me questions I didn't know the answers to, so I thought I'd bring in experts so we can learn from them. Like, just this week I've got this guy who the movie 21 was based off of. He's part of the MIT blackjack card counting team. These guys made $10 million counting cards in Las Vegas and around the world and stuff. So there's always something really fun and interesting. There's so many interesting people out there. Once you open the doors, you see that there's a lot of people that you can learn from. So yeah, they should definitely try and follow us there as well.
I love the curiosity. And any shows coming up that our listeners should...
I am touring all over the country. So I don't know when you guys are dropping this, but we're going to be in DC, then going to go to Canada, do Vancouver, Surrey, Calgary, going to Europe, going to Toronto, going to Ottawa. I am all over the world. People can follow me, MazJobrani.com. And on all my socials, it's just at MazJobrani.
Thank you so much for coming on Persian Girl Podcast.
Yeah, it was an honor to have you.
Thank you, guys.
And happy almost Nowruz.
Happy almost Nowruz. All right, you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Good thoughts, good words, good deeds. Don't forget.
Bye. Bye. Bye.